Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. Since the end of the Cold War, and especially since 9/11, the United States' focus of attention has shifted away from Russia. That is not to say Russia is not important to us, but merely that our relationship has changed dramatically, to say the least. We are now more like partners than adversaries. But perhaps, as David Broder wrote in the Washington Post earlier this week, because of Iraq, American relationships with other countries around the world have been bent out of shape or suffered from neglect. During this hour, Focus 580, we'll talk about U.S. relations with Russia and some of the issues we face together in the coming decade. Our guest is a scholar who has contributed a great deal to our relationship with Russia, Susan Eisenhower. She's long been involved in fostering dialogue and cooperation between the two nations, from before the demise of the Soviet Union, in fact. She now serves as chairman and senior fellow of the Eisenhower Institute, a policy institute in Washington focusing on serving the long-term interests of the American people while promoting justice and international peace. She's the author of three books, two of which, Breaking Free and Mrs. Ike, have appeared on the bestseller list. Susan Eisenhower has also been appointed to the National Academy of Sciences Standing Committee on International Security and Arms Control and has written both scholarly works and commentary in the press on Islam and Central Asia. She has been appointed by the Secretary of Energy to a commission on nuclear non-proliferation programs in Russia, to the International Space Station Management and Cost Evaluation Task Force, and is a director of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the Nuclear Threat Initiative. She's also served two terms on the Advisory Council of NASA, and you may also have seen Susan Eisenhower's many op-eds in major U.S. newspapers and as an analyst on the major broadcast news programs. We could say much more about her work, but if we covered it all, we would simply run out of time for discussion. One thing we must add, however, is that Susan Eisenhower will be speaking here on campus, the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, this evening at 7:30 in the Spurlock Museum, 600 South Gregory Street, Urbana. This is an event in the Center for Advanced Study Millicom Lecture Series, and it is free and open to the public. Tonight, Ms. Eisenhower will speak on the subject of U.S.-Russian relations in the coming decade, and we'll cover some of that large territory during this hour of Focus 580. As we talk with Susan Eisenhower, you are invited into the conversation. All you have to do is pick up the telephone. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest, if you're listening on the air or if you're listening online, anywhere in the continental U.S., 800-222-9455. Susan Eisenhower, good morning.
Good morning, Jack. Great to be here.
Thanks for being here. I almost had you talking about cosmology there for a minute. I wanted to start by seeing if you wanted to say something about the Eisenhower Institute and the kind of work that you do.
Well, the Eisenhower Institute was established in 1983 to promote many of the intellectual and leadership legacies of Dwight Eisenhower. And obviously in that area, he had a long political and intellectual career, including being president of a major university, which was Columbia. But we thought that there were a number of areas where he was critically important, especially during its time, the start of the Cold War. And so we designed our program to focus on international security issues, especially on nuclear questions. He was also the first president of the space age, and it seemed logical to put together a program on space, and so that may rationalize some of my a CV there, which sounds like I've been all over the map, but in fact, these are all very connected issues. And in fact, with respect to Russia, anybody who has spent a time looking at Russian issues has to know a fair amount about space and nuclear issues, because these are the two areas that that country has had an international leadership position.
Mm-hmm. Well, and indeed, you had very early experiences with U.S.-Russian relations very directly, obviously. And in fact, as a young girl, met Nikita Khrushchev and had an opportunity to see a lot of the evolution of our own relationship, our feelings about the Soviet Union, and attempts to come to grips and end the Cold War. You were very much involved in that.
Well, you know, I think that meeting with Khrushchev was really very important in my life. And in looking back on how I became interested, there had to be some kind of trigger point in a way. I have to confess right now that what I know about the region, I have learned very intensively over a 20-year period. but actually I started my career as a journalist. And at the time, it didn't seem logical to go into U.S.-Soviet affairs because it was mostly oriented around what we call in Washington bean counting, which is counting the number of nuclear warheads. And there was a very elaborate set of negotiations that went on throughout a large part of the Cold War. And this was mostly a male-dominated field. So it didn't occur to me as a young person to orient myself in that direction. But I was always fascinated by Soviet and then Russian things, largely, I think, because of this meeting with Khrushchev. He was a larger-than-life character. He looked a little bit like a Santa Claus without the red hat and white tassel. He was certainly shaped the right way. And he was a person who made quite an impression on everybody who met him. I was only about 9 at the time, but I couldn't get over the fact that he came as a guest to my grandparents' farm while I was hearing not only from people at school and from my family to some degree that, you know, he represented the Soviet Union, which is an enemy of the United States. I couldn't figure out if he wasn't a friend of the United States what he was doing at our farm. So this kind of complexity and contradiction, in a sense, was something that fascinated me, you know, from that moment on. Since I got involved in the field many years ago, now 1985, I made my first trip there, and I did so actually from the standpoint of my business career, because I went from journalism into business. It then evolved into a real fascination with the whole policy underpinnings, the way the United States has looked at this part of the world. And then as we I was already traveling intensively there. I think I'd probably made 20-something trips to the Soviet Union before the collapse of that country. And I guess for full disclosure purposes, I have to say after about my 5th visit there, I met somebody who later became my husband. He was at the time the head of the Soviet Union's planetary space program. I say planetary, but we'd like to make a quick distinction here between their military and their civilian program. But we met in 1987 and married in 1990. And he had become a radical reformer, was a member of parliament. Actually, I'm very proud of the fact that he was the first person in the history of the Soviet Union to vote against a piece of legislation. And when they didn't cart him out of the voting hall, of course, he had to hold his hand up for 15 whole minutes because nobody knew how to count a no vote. It had never happened. They didn't know whether you had to write it on a separate piece of paper or whatever. So, as he says, when they didn't haul him out of the, you know, the parliamentary hall there, on the next vote, 6 people voted with him, again against the regime. And as they say, the rest is history. This was a very dynamic, dangerous time, and it's very interesting to me in a lot of ways that we have kind of created a sense of nostalgia for what came right after the collapse of the Soviet Union, that is the Boris Yeltsin years. I think while Boris Yeltsin played an indispensable role in averting widespread bloodshed at the time of that collapse, he really set a time bomb with respect to a number of issues that the Russian Federation is facing today, and I think that's Mr. Putin's challenge.
Mm. Well, I certainly want to follow up on that because that's a big issue, or set of issues. But I also wanted to, you know, not leave this part of the story because I think it's very interesting. Obviously, Khrushchev made a very big impression on you as a 9-year-old girl, but it also seemed that the adults around you said, "Don't trust him." You know, it was part of this whole ideological opposition that we. You know, they were so different from us in our minds that, you know, they were communists. Their way of life was different. It certainly was, you know, in many ways a very oppressive government. So, I mean, it stood in opposition to the United States. And so you had this message, don't trust these people.
Oh, absolutely. And add to that, one of the really the most beautiful items in my grandparents' house was this beautiful portrait that hung over the mantelpiece in their living room, and it was given to my grandfather by Jan Masaryk, who was the foreign minister of Czechoslovakia. And I grew up knowing that Jan Masaryk had been pushed from a window by the communists during the communist coup in 1948. So, and I guess there's still a fair debate about the circumstances of Masaryk's death. But needless to say, in my frame of reference, if you said communist, one's eyes got very large. You know, you'd think, oh, defenestration, being thrown from a window. I mean, it was the word communist to our generation was equated with thoughts of oppression, random violence. It was a very frightening concept, not to mention, of course, communism associated with an international expansionist ideal plus nuclear weapons. And we're not talking about atomic weapons. We're talking about thermonuclear hydrogen devices that had the capacity to blow up the world God knows how many times. In fact, sometimes I think it's ironic that we're told today that the world is a more dangerous place than it was during the Cold War. I think this is simply not a viable proposition. We came awfully close to annihilation during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And we'd be well advised to remember that the world has always been a dangerous place and we just face different challenges at different times. Nevertheless, I think it would be fair to say that I carried significant Cold War baggage. I think I was certainly raised in my family to make a distinction between the Russian and the Soviet people and their regime, but there were no illusions about the regime or its objectives.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, my question after that is, and yet, you didn't completely buy into the idea that the Russian people were bad. In other words, you held on to that impression and carried it forward and were interested enough to try to cross the bridge.
Well, it was a huge journey for me. I'm not sure that it was a bigger journey for me than it might be for anybody else, just because a whole world was taken up by this Cold War, and there were a tremendous number of stereotypes. But, you know, there's a huge difference between having these fears you take to bed with you at night and actually getting on a plane and going over there and meeting people directly. And while it was clear that the people who worked for the regime were very constrained by what they could say, and you could tell that some were clearly bad guys, but others would hint things to you that gave you the strong impression that it was a considerably more complicated situation than what one understood. And then, of course, when I met the person who's now my husband, it was a complete eye-opener. This was a person who was very important in that society. And yet he frequently spoke to me openly about the rot within the system and how the Communist Party was a complete failure and how it had been the source of so much international angst and unhappiness. He felt tremendously guilty on his country's behalf about what happened in Eastern Europe. And I found this completely riveting. I mean, here's a person who, you know, holds an important position in the Soviet Union, who was not only very capable of self-examination, but was in many ways more critical of his government than many Americans were about theirs. And so once a contradiction is set in place, then any good intellectual feels the necessity to probe this further. And I think George Orwell summed it up perfectly when he basically said that what determines the longevity of the ruling of a ruling party is the attitude of the ruling elite itself. The truth is that the Soviet Union collapsed because members of the Communist Party bolted. You know, they no longer had a consensus within the party to do what had to be done to stay in power.
We're talking this morning with Susan Eisenhower. She's chairman and senior fellow at the Eisenhower Institute in Washington, and we're discussing U.S.-Russian relations and a variety of issues that pertain. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And Susan Eisenhower will also be speaking tonight at 7:30 in the Spurlock Museum, a wonderful place, 600 South Gregory, Urbana. That's in the Center for Advanced Study Millicom Lecture Series, and it is free and open to the public. I quoted David Broder in the introduction, and I wonder what you think of the quote, "Has our relationship with Russia suffered in recent times from neglect because of, you know, the war on terror, Iraq, etc.?
Well, I'm afraid that our relations with Russia got off to the wrong start. And I say Russia as opposed to the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. We have to take ourselves back to that period in 1991. The trouble really started, I think, just before the collapse of the Soviet Union, and that centered around our understanding of what the abortive coup attempt really meant. And you may remember at the time that the United States government supported Gorbachev in that process. And what they didn't realize is that the coup was not successful because the Soviet people were there to restore Gorbachev to power. They were there to support Boris Yeltsin. There has been a prevailing feeling in Washington, probably it has its roots in the Cold War, that the Russian people don't really have an opinion of their own, that they are the they are the slaves of the regime. And I think this is absolutely fascinating because everything I've learned over 20 years of traveling to that country is that that's really not the case. This is an extraordinarily opinionated group of people, as a matter of fact, and there is a real issue as to whether Russia is actually governable or not. It's not the reverse, that this is a nation of slaves. But even today, despite everything that's being said about Putin's crackdown on journalism and free speech, the most vociferous attacks against Boris Yeltsin are coming out of Russian newspapers. Stunning. Pavel Felgengauer, who I respect a great deal, he's an analyst in military affairs, calls the Putin regime despotic. I mean, it's hard to imagine anybody using language like that in this country, first of all, because we're not despotic, but secondly, even if we were, we just are a little bit more polite. And this is a group of people with strongly held views, not surprisingly, since many of them lost family members, parents or grandparents during the purges or during various forms of various periods of Russian Soviet atrocities, and this is a group of people who survived more losses than anybody else during World War II. Mm-hmm. This is a tough bunch. Mm-hmm. And they've got their opinions, and I think Putin may suffer from having not enough control and not enough levers of power, effective levers of power, that enable him to control the country the way even a normal functioning government would need to be able to do so. So that just because he says he's going to seize and control, or it looks that way, doesn't mean he's going to be successful by any means.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, though, on the surface, it would seem to be a setback for democratic rule. I don't know. I guess I'm curious what you've given us a little bit of a take on that, and you have a much deeper understanding of the realities of, as you say, the Russian culture and the way people respond or don't. But, determining the governors and the leaders in 89 provinces by appointment rather than election would not be, at least on the face of it, seem very democratic.
Well, first of all, we're assuming that 89 – first of all, let me just say that there is a positive construction on this and there's a negative construction, and nobody knows whether the outcome is going to be positive or negative. We can only assume that if the negative description of these events turns out to continue to be negative, then that's one set of issues. If it's the positive construction turns out to be the case, it's another. If this is a setback for democracy, then you'll have a controlled environment that is rather similar to what we have in China. Now, it's interesting. We rarely these days stand up and make a big deal about human rights abuses in China. As a matter of fact, the Russians have to be looking across their border and seeing Russia's economy boom. It so happens that the Chinese actually have appointed governors in their huge country, and this is not an issue for the United States government. They also, have the fastest growing economy, one of the fastest growing in the world, if not the fastest growing. And there was always a debate after the collapse of the Soviet Union if Gorbachev had made a mistake by liberalizing the political environment first before tackling economic growth. So setback for democracy. Putin may have a longer view. He may say to himself, chaos that democracy can bring without requisite institutions to support them is actually more threatening to the long-term viability of the Russian state than economic development. And he's in a race against time to bring up the standards of living to a more uniform state. And so that might be a bad that might be the worst case, is that it looks more like a China model. The best case is that this is Clinton's attempt to do something that is critically important, which is to effectively crack down on corruption. And we are assuming that the governors of these 89 regions are decent, upstanding, terrific guys who won elections in an American-style way. Actually, this is a pretty miserable bunch of people there. Some of them even have kind of the feel of being warlords themselves. This is a country with 11 time zones. I mean, it's huge. It is huge. This is more than twice the size of the United States. And some of these elections produce guys who literally bought the elections. Some of them are in gubernatorial positions right now because it gives them immunity against prosecution. And some of them are laundering drug money. And, you know, this is not necessarily 89 terrific, upstanding people. And one of the lessons of Beslan is that this corruption problem is so serious that it's even bringing about connection points to very specific acts of terrorism and loss of life. We know that the terrorist attacks, that the series that have occurred here in Russia in the last couple of months were made possible by the capacity of terrorists to bribe public officials. So the best construction of what Putin has done would be to assess this as his attempt to try and put a cadre of people who are answerable to him, and that he is going to hold them to certain standards of non-corruption, the way the Communist Party tried to do during Soviet times.
Well, very good. We have a call to talk with Lisa Kulin in our conversation. We have with us Susan Eisenhower. She's a senior fellow and chairman of the Eisenhower Institute. We're talking about U.S.-Russian relations and a variety of issues that pertain. If you would like to join us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Our first caller on line number two in Urbana. Good morning.
Good morning. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the situation in the North Caucasus and also Chechnya and how that impacts the Soviet-American relation.
Yes, certainly. Delighted to. Well, the situation in the North Caucasus is, of course, very serious. It's been serious for a long time. In fact, this whole part of the world has been a serious problem for Russia since the Russian Empire. As you well know, the Tsarist regimes fought a 50-year war in Chechnya, and so this is the extension of great difficulties that existed there for a long time. And I think it's worth noting that during World War II, Joseph Stalin literally deported the Chechen people from their homeland because of alleged conspiracy with the Germans. And this is at the heart of course, the grievances of ordinary Chechens. What makes this situation so incredibly complex is that everybody's got a point of view, and there are also geostrategic considerations in place. The point of view is very obvious. The Chechen people have had one of the most tragic and unjust histories of any group of people one would care to think about. And certainly the separatist movement that started at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union has been seen with sympathy, and I think rightly so, by most civilized countries of the world. Boris Yeltsin has a very checkered legacy as president. As I said, he deserves a lot of credit for averting a catastrophe at the time of the in the immediate aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union, but Chechnya really ranks right up there as one of his biggest disasters. He sent troops in 1994 to quell separatist tendencies there, and that was clearly not the route to take. After 2 years of horrendous bloodshed and stagnation in the process, Russia got out of the war thanks to General Alexander Lebed, the late Alexander Lebed, who negotiated a peace treaty, but really he deferred all of the big issues on Chechen independence. And in this particular case, Chechnya really basically had its de facto independence for several years. And this is where the Chechens now are at fault. During these several years, they did not at all manage their early sort of newfound autonomy. And there are lots of reasons for it. It's not really their fault. I mean, they were bordering on this kind of failed state question. But at that time, because state structures were weak and the country had already been damaged badly by the war and there was a huge amount of corruption, the money that Russia was sending there for reconstruction never made it to the projects. There is no doubt, and I've had this confirmed by people with major security clearances, that foreign Islamic forces filled some of that void, provided financing. They are not necessarily, they don't make up the whole of the Chechen insurgency or a rebellion, if you want to call it that, but they do play a role. There's a famous Arab named Hattab who has played a major role in the Chechen situation. And at that time, they beheaded a number of, took many Russian hostages during this de facto independence period. Beheaded a number of them and did what they're doing today in Iraq by showing this on websites and in video. And this inflamed, obviously, sentiments on both sides. And then, of course, Putin was brought to power, actually, as a young, energetic person to try and take control over a national crisis because of a number of apartment buildings, several of which were in Moscow itself. So Putin has really been born by this crisis. He'll live by it. He'll die by it, I'm sure. I mean, this is a very, very serious problem. But we are at a point where everybody's got a viewpoint, especially given the fact that the second war, which started in 1999, started as a result not only of these bombings, apartment bombings, but also because a group of Islamic insurgents invaded another part of the Russian Federation called Dagestan, which is a neighboring country. Dagestan is a country or is a region of Russia that has enormous importance. The oil pipeline goes from Baku to the west through Dagestan. It is coastally located with respect to Caspian oil reserves. And so you can see this has got all the makings of a long, protracted, very unpleasant situation. And I say right now we need international help for this. There's no way that the Russian Federation itself is going to be able to cope with this. But in order to do that, and this is the answer to the second part of your question, we've got to take a much more constructive rhetorical position with respect to Russia. I don't think we need to give them a pass on anything. On the contrary. But Putin has said that he reserves the right to take preemptive measures against those harboring terrorists, and I'm afraid that he's taken a page right out of George W. Bush's playbook. We, the United States, has reserved that right internationally, and so we have to at least be prepared to deal with the fact that Russia has gone through a terrible spate of terrorist attacks, each more heinous than the other. And now we're going to have to find some kind of constructive language to avert international chaos by another major country exercising this option for itself.
Okay, that's great. Does the United States actually have a stated policy on the situation in Chechnya?
Well, I think the United States is between a rock and a hard place, if you know what I mean, in that nobody likes the situation in Chechnya. There is no doubt that a significant part of the Chechen population sees this as a secessionist issue. On the other hand, there's also no doubt that the Chechens have employed acts that are so heinous that they can only be described as terrorism. And our real problem is that internationally we don't have a definition of what terrorism is. At the United Nations earlier this week, George Bush implied that terrorism does not have its roots in grievances. And then the president turns around and says that there can only be a political solution to what happened in Beslan. So the Russians themselves have obviously taken umbrage because, as Putin snapped back in a rather, frankly, inelegant way. So should we be suggesting to you that you invite Osama bin Laden to the White House to discuss what he's prepared to stop doing in exchange for what you're prepared to do for him? And then he went on to say, you know, don't ask us to enter into negotiation with child killers. And so we've got some definitional – I'm not making any judgment about who's right or wrong here. I'm saying we've got some definitional problems. I think there's still a reservoir of goodwill on the subject of international terrorism in Russia. But I would say that that reservoir could be shrinking, and we've got to be very careful about this because we need the Russians in our own international war on terrorism for at least two very specific reasons. First of all, we need their intelligence capacity. They still know an awful lot about Afghanistan, let's face it, and they've been extremely helpful in our campaign there. They've also been very helpful in Central Asia. And then even more importantly, we need their cooperation in helping them secure their nuclear stockpile, their nuclear materials, because it's in our interest that they do so. The threat of international terrorists gaining access to unsecured nuclear materials and using this for a dirty bomb incident, you know, that would be a nuclear attack of some sort, you know, is real. And what's clear from the Beslan situation is that Russia, because of its economic problems, did not have enough money to have organization for its security services. And there's a tremendous amount of corruption within these security services because of the standard of livings and the collapses of the economy and all kinds of other things. And we are really in this together. So my own hope is that we're going to find some kind of constructive language here and that we're going to step back from the temptation to use Russia as a political issue in our own campaign here because it is absolutely too important and because of a lot of other reasons I won't take the opportunity to raise right now. You know, the Russians have had mixed signals from the United States about our intentions towards that part of the world. And so we need some active fence mending here. And I think we can actually gain from this experience and find further ways to cooperate in a mutually beneficial way. But it's very delicate, and it could go the other way quite easily, I think.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. We have a couple callers waiting. We'll go next to a listener in Champaign on line number 3. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, thank you. You already touched on it briefly, but I was wondering if you could go into more detail about the relationship of oil in all this conflict and you know, and how it affects relations between Russia and not only Chechnya, but Azerbaijan and Georgia. And if you feel that how this all connects up or it relates to what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, you know, thank you for that question. It's a very, very complex, interlinked question. And so rather than get into kind of a history of where the oil's located and how the pipelines work and everything, I think the main fact that is necessary to know here is that Chechnya, of course, used to have oil. It has less oil now than it had before the war. Refinery capacity. Dagestan, as I mentioned, is a crucially important geostrategic location for Russia, and there are completely porous borders between Chechnya and Dagestan, as evidenced by this invasion in 1999. And the worst-case scenario in today's environment is that, in fact, that there would be another invasion if the Chechens manage to come out of this in a certain way, There's concern that, of course, the terrorists or radical elements would try for Dagestan again. And I think this is a source of international concern because if you look at the geography there, it's a mountainous area, and you could see a kind of Afghanistan scenario where terrorists are, you know, controlling the hills and interfering with and possibly disrupting pipeline activity. Because their goals, actually, I believe the goals of Shamil Basayev, anyway, the mastermind behind the Beslan and airline bombings here of the last month or so, his objectives, I believe, are to try and shake this region loose from the Russian Federation. And he has done this very cleverly by putting together a group of 30 people who attack the school who are made up of an array of nationalities that have historic grievances against each other. One of the most worrisome elements to come out of this is the fear by the Ingush communities that there's going to be a revenge taken on them for what happened at this school. So you've got longstanding blood feuds, you've got oil pipelines and oil reserves, and then you have the United States looking at Russia, rightly so, as a possible source of oil. To reduce our dependency on Middle Eastern oil. Now, there are transportation reasons why that isn't going to come online right away, but already Russia exports oil to the United States. And it is seen as, a real hedge over the long haul. By the way, how are these things connected? Just last week, Putin announced the merger of Rosneft and Gazprom, making this new company one of the world's biggest players in the oil and gas area, about five times the size of ExxonMobil now. I mean, the merger hasn't gone through, but and so you do see the nexus of all these points. And without, boring the listeners too much on these details, the bottom line is this is one of the reasons why it's critical that we adopt the right approach towards Russia at the moment. We have to remember that the Russian people kicked the communists out of power themselves. Putin has defeated the Communist Party as a political force within the Russian Federation. So all of the communist overhang is over. I was one of those who believed it was over as of 1991, having known something about Russian public opinion. But now the world understands that the communist thing is over in Russia. Now it's really still in our hands to assure that the capitalist country that has emerged, and trust me when I tell you they've got capitalism in a big way there, but that the capitalist country that emerges is going to be a friendly capitalist country and not one, that could go its own way because there are too many other partners they could hook up with around the world that would be far less desirable than us as partners.
What do you think the likelihood is that Putin will use terrorism as an excuse to invade Georgia and take control of the pipeline that BP is building through Georgia to transport oil out of Azerbaijan?
Well, I guess I'm going to say something really very controversial here. The minute you go down the preemption route, is the minute that all kinds of scenarios are in place that weren't there before. The fact that the United States has chosen to make this part of our own policy opens the way for the Russian Federation to do it without embarrassment. With respect to that particular pipeline, I think even the United States government has acknowledged that there are Islamic terrorists in the Pankisi Gorge. This is a region of Georgia that has been, off and on been regarded as a haven for these, Chechen, whatever we're going to call them, freedom fighters, terrorists, whatever we're going to call them. And of course, Georgia says that they don't have terrorists in this region, I think because they are deeply fearful that this will result in exactly what you describe. the problem is that if preemption had not become an acceptable scenario, we'd have a little bit more leverage on this. But we do live in a world where it has been deemed important to be able to take preemptive action. And without, you know, getting into my personal opinion on this subject, on the one hand, that makes tremendous amount of sense. On the other hand, it does open Pandora's box because the United States can't have one rule for itself and one rule for everybody else. So, again, I think the Russians, everything I know about the Russians tells me that they are still well-disposed and still care about Western opinion. For myself, I've always thought that the single dangerous, most dangerous thing that could happen in Russia today is the moment when they don't care what we think anymore. And that is the day I'm not going to get on an airplane and go to that part of the world, because my protection, or the protection of everybody that's gone into even the most unstable parts of that region, rest around the fact that the leadership cares about U.S. public opinion. I have to also, if this is of any interest, I had the fascinating experience of my husband and I spending an hour and a half with Vladimir Putin about a year and a half ago. And it's not that we know this man particularly. It's the first time we've ever met, but he invited us to come to his dacha outside of Moscow to talk about U.S.-Russian relations. And I can tell you that he said at that time, and he has said it again in the last couple of days, that relations with the United States are number one. They are his strategic objective. And when he gets rebuffed with a lack of understanding of his problem in this case being how to protect his population from increasingly heinous terrorist attacks. There may be all sorts of ways that Putin could solve this problem, but he is trying to solve it for better or for worse, and let's hope it's not worse. I personally don't support the consolidation of the Kremlin-appointed governors. I don't support it because I don't think it's going to work. But having said that, we could engage with them more deeply on trying to find a common language on how we fight these problems together. But as I said earlier, we've got a big definitional problem. Mm. Forgive me for an extremely long-winded way of kind of slightly evading your question. I don't think we know what's going to happen in that pipeline. We don't know whether Putin is going to go into the Pankisi Gorge. He has hinted that he's going to take some kind of measures. I mean, he's left the same options for himself that we've left for ourselves. And this is absolutely, this minute as we sit here, is the time for us to be on airplanes and be over there talking to them about the long-term implications of this and finding other ways to solve this problem, because the international community has suggested a stabilization fund for Chechnya. There are a number of other measures. I don't think we've explored in this country nearly enough the options we could make for isolating terrorism rather than inadvertently fanning more flames. So I think it's going to be an open question, and we're going to have to actually be assertive about this rather than simply hopeful.
Very good. We have just about 8 minutes left in our conversation with Susan Eisenhower, Chairman and Senior Fellow at the Eisenhower Institute, and we have a couple callers waiting. I will get right to them, but I want to make sure that we ask about this, what you can say about the status of Russia's nuclear fissile material, the discarded weapons that have been mothballed, and the safety and the securing of those materials.
Well, this is a fascinating area. I've been to Russia's premier nuclear weapons facility twice. I've been inside the third perimeter fence. I mean, in my field, that's a pretty big thrill, I have to tell you. We were there looking to evaluate U.S.-funded nonproliferation programs for the Department of Energy. I have to say a tremendous amount has been done, but here's the concern, that all of the easy sites to secure have already been secured. And now we're in big negotiations with the Russians about the conditions for going into super-sensitive sites. We have to remember this is a sovereign country. We are not offering reciprocity in the United States, and so this really depends on Russia's trust of us and their goodwill. And I think this is absolutely critical. It should be at the top of our agenda. A number of these programs, very regrettably, have been put on hold. They've probably stopped. We've allocated plenty of money for this, but in fact, we have some ongoing issues with the Russians about legal liability questions. And so some of these programs that were there to engage the nuclear complex have stalled. I have long taken the position that we can't have a Cold War and a war on terrorism simultaneously. We've got to decide what is most important for the security of this country. I happen to believe, I agree with President Bush in this, that the international effort to avert terrorist attacks and the terrorism and the activity of non-state actors in being able to utilize technology and to harm the security of our people is numero uno. We need the Russians in this process. And by the way, they're not communists anymore, so I think there's still an opening here. And maybe I'm too optimistic, but a lot of good things have changed in that country. We have to build on the things that have worked, I think.
I'm hearing in a lot of your comments that the notion that there is this hangover that we have about communism. And I guess in the people that I know, I don't sense that we do understand. We've moved past that.
Well, you see, I think a lot of people, obviously the communists had talked about, they had an expansionist ideology. What America has not gotten over is every time Russia tries to improve, now it's done some things that are clearly questionable. I just need to put that caveat in there. But every time they try to improve their economic ties with parts of the former Soviet Union, because after all, that's how their economy functioned, we get concerned about whether they're trying to reestablish an empire. Hmm. You know, the word communism has been dropped, but, you know, kind of the things that made up communism seem to still linger. I've got to tell you, I have never met a Russian who wants to reinstitute the Soviet Union. This was an empire where the Russian Federation actually paid more money to have this empire than the reverse, because really